welcome you this morning to one of several Sunday school classes that are being taught in the building this morning. And if you perchance just wandered into this class, this is a class on the biblical foundations of American history. And I believe we're probably teaching history like it hasn't been taught in this country for 60 to 70 years, and that is because we're placing an emphasis back on the things that markedly indicate that this nation was founded on biblical or Christian principles. And those have been removed in the teaching of American history for the last 40 years anyway, and so we're trying to just put them back in. I don't have any bones to pick with the school system. Well, I guess I do have a lot of bones to pick with the school system, but I'm not trying to be antagonistic. I'm not trying to be ugly, but I think they've done a great disservice to the American people by depriving them of the knowledge of where they actually came from. And, of course, the attempt is made, I think, to kind of expunge God from every area of life. And in so doing, they've actually gone back in many cases and rewritten American history, which is, to me, as grievous a crime against the American people as what Hitler did to the Germans back in the 30s. And so, Lord willing, we're going to come through here and consider these things again. Isaiah chapter 49, maybe an unusual place to begin, but this is a verse that was quoted in the journals and diaries of a great individual that actually this country owes its existence to, Christopher Columbus. Verse number 1 and verse number 6. Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. The Lord hath called me from the womb, and from the bowels of my mother hath he made mention of my name. Verse number 6. And he said, it is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up tribute. Let me read this correctly this morning. It is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. And Columbus had both of those references in his diary in reference to God leading him to the new world. And this morning, although this is American history, we're going to delve back just a little bit deeper to give you some overview of what was going on at the time that this nation was founded. You know, if you look just to the south of us, you find several nations that are in virtual poverty. And those nations, in the last 200 to 300 years of their existence, the people there have lived in poverty. They have never prospered. They have never exceeded or excelled at anything as a nation. And yet they have more natural resources in most cases than we do here in this country. And if you just look at the topography or at the existence or the cultures that are involved, you'll immediately see there's something different about what took place here in the continental United States. And when we consider those to the north of us, even people there who have a great country and land mass as large or larger than the continental United States, and another country there that is molded a great deal after some of the principles of our American government, and yet the Canadians have never enjoyed the prosperity that America has enjoyed. That ought to cause just the common individual to wonder what's different about this country. You hear a lot about the West. Everything is blamed on the West and the Western influence and all of this. But I remind you, Mexico is in the West as well as Canada. And those countries do not prosper nearly as much as this country. And so I say again, there must be something that would compel you to find what it is that's different about America as opposed to, say, Canada, or as opposed to Mexico or the continent of South America. You have to see that America virtually is the only part of the Western Hemisphere that's prospered. The rest of the Western Hemisphere carries along much like the rest of the Eastern Hemisphere. Some of it in poverty, some of it in moderate income, but no real standouts like the American continent. What is it about this nation that is different from all the others? Now, I'm going to teach some things this morning. It'll be a little heavy. give you a lot of church history this morning, and we won't hear a whole lot about America till the very end when we start talking about the settling in America, but we want to lay some foundations and give you an idea, particularly of what's going on in Europe. You know, many people do not realize when Columbus sailed and set sail for America, a lot of things in Europe were in great turmoil. A lot of things going on in Europe, and we oftentimes don't place them in the same agenda because we learn them in two different categories. One of the crimes in removing religion from education is the fact that you learn religion over here, and you learn history over here, and you never combine the two. But I will give you some indications this morning. As a matter of fact, Martin Luther is 10 years of age when Columbus sails for America. So the Reformation is still about 20 years away. And those things form the basis on which, under which Europe is being governed at the time. Let me go back this morning. I want you to know we are doing real well. I only have 6 pages of notes this morning. And so last week we had 11. We can kind of slow down and take a little more moderate pace today. We don't have to get nearly as much of a hurry, I hope, than what we did last year. But when we consider the basis of the American existence, we're going to first look at Europe. Everybody see that? Now, this is just to give you an idea for some of you that may have graduated from college or high school in the last 5 or 6 years and don't know anything about world geography. Of course, it probably wouldn't help you because most of you can't read anyway. But let me just go through here. You've got England, the islands to the north here, Spain to the south, France, of course, the African continent down here across the Mediterranean, Italy. Back up in this area over here is what's known as Bohemia, and up in through here is what became eventually the Germanic states. And I didn't put all those in because at this point in time, when we're going to look, a lot of these places are just tribal warfare and not really settled as far as the countries are concerned, changing land boundaries. But you have basically 4 countries here who are involved in running the show in Europe. And it do you well to remember who these countries are. First of all, Italy. Secondly, Spain, France, and England. And I'm going to give you some ideas about these countries. Now, as far as Spain is concerned, Spain at this point in time in history, when we go back to around the 13th or 14th century, Spain is still involved in a warfare to drive the Moors out of Spanish territory. The Moors had invaded from down in Africa, came across the Mediterranean 17 centuries before. In other words, the Moors have controlled that part of the country since before the time of Christ. And at this point in time, the 13th, 14th century, of course, Ferdinand and Isabella are involved here at the time of Columbus. But even prior to that, a warfare is being waged to try and drive the Moors out of their occupation of southern Europe here, and particularly in Spain. As a matter of fact, it is the defeat of the Moors that gives Columbus his money and supplies necessary to sail to America. Because of the victory that Ferdinand and Isabella had over the Moors, they decided they wanted to do something for God in payment for that victory, and their payment was to outfit or to equip Christopher Columbus and his expedition that would come to the New World. So Spain is involved in warfare, been involved in warfare for years. When you get down or on up to England and France, in England and France, we have going on basically at this time what's known as the 100 Years' War. The 100 Years' War. I need you to go to my office. I just thought of something I want to read you folks. Inside my briefcase, there is a black volume 6, I think, of Shaw's Church History. I think it's the only one in my briefcase. The 100 Years' War is being fought between France and England. How long did the 100 Years' War last? Wrong. I think it lasted 104 or 107 years. Don't ask me why they call it the 100 Years' War, but that's just you'll hear that one on Jeopardy every once in a while. That's a good trivia question. The war is being waged here. Now, the reason I point this out is because of all this warfare going on. When warfare is being waged, it gives rise to strong monarchies, strong kings. And of course, the King of England and the King of France are opposed in a deadlock warfare here. The King and Queen of Spain involved against the Moorish kings. And what happens when you get involved in a wartime situation is nationalism begins to increase. nationalism begins to increase. Now, the reason that's important is because of what I'm going to say about the papacy over the next few moments. The papacy, or the popes in Rome, have at this point in time secured absolute control in all of Europe that is there. Thank you. They have controlled all of Europe. I'll read just in a moment a papal bull and what was stated, but the statement of this basically is that the Roman Catholic Pope in Rome controls all civil government. All civil kings and prelates are subject to him and must carry out his decrees under punishment of excommunication. And his attempt, and the reason he put that out, was to try and solidify what he was fast losing because of the growing nationalistic ties. The Roman Catholic papacy had ascended, and we won't have time to go that far back in church history, but the Crusades have ended around the middle or the end of the 12th century, or 12, well, it was about 1292, I think, the last crusade, which resulted in just a fiasco for the Roman Catholic Church. Millions and millions and millions of people died in the Crusades, trying to recapture, of course, various places in the world, and all of them failed. The biggest one was the Children's Crusade. I think there was around 70,000 children that starved to death in the Alps because the little boy saw a vision, and the Queen of Heaven told him that they were supposed to, as children, go and take back the promised land for the Catholic Church, and the Pope put his stamp of approval on that, and 70,000 children starved to death in the Alps. They never even got to the borders of Europe. They starved to death. And so all of this was a great embarrassment to the church. Now, I want you to understand when I'm speaking this morning, I'm speaking about the papacy. I don't believe there's any animosity between me and any Roman Catholic in this country. I believe in your right to worship as you would, but I want you to know that I am adamantly opposed to the papacy. Always have been. I am not a papist. I am, as a matter of fact, I'm as anti-papacy as probably anybody you've ever met, because you say, well, you're just, you're just biased. I bet I know more of Catholic history than you know. And you want to go through it, we'll sit down and look at it. I'll tell you why I'm opposed to papacy. I can trace what it has done through the centuries, and the papacy is in control of Europe proper. With the Hundred Years' War, the King of England, the King of France begin to fight one another. And of course, when you're fighting another country, you think your country is the best. And so they begin to disallow the things that the Pope's saying. And the thing that comes to interest here, of course, Joan of Arc fought in the Hundred Years' War. If you remember Joan of Arc, 1431, the Battle of Orleans, she saw a vision and supposedly, saved her countrymen, who later on captured her and sold her to the English. She was burned at the stake. She was excommunicated from the church. And 100 years later, she was readmitted to the church and made a saint. So it's kind of unusual about what they wanted to do with Joan there. But Joan of Arc was a French citizen and fought on the side of the French in the Hundred Years' War. Boniface VIII is the first pope that we'll mention this morning. And the reason we'll mention him is because he is the one that comes to the forefront about the time the Hundred Years' War is being fought. How many of you remember? How long was the Hundred Years' War? Over 100 years, okay? Longer than 100 years. And Boniface VIII comes to the throne in Rome, or comes to the chair in Rome as the Pope, and his desire is to end this 100 years war, basically because both England and France had cut off tax money going to the church. They were using their tax monies to fund their war effort, and they had denied the removal of funds from their countries to the papal see at Rome, and because of that, there was emptiness in the coffers. So Boniface VIII, he issues his papal bull called Unum Sanctum. I'm going to read some of that to you. I can read it to you in Latin if you'd like, but I'll read it to you in English. This papal bull has never been rescinded by the Catholic Church. It still stands today in all of its integrity, but here are some of the statements. Unum Sanctum, meaning one controller, one ruler. And he says here, upon our faith, we are obliged to believe and hold that there is one holy, Catholic, and apostolic church. And we firmly believe and profess that outside of her there is no salvation nor remission of sins, period. In other words, this is the initial teaching that the Roman Catholic Church is the one true church, and that you cannot get to heaven any other way than through her means right there. speaking about two powers, that in her and within her power are two swords. We are taught in the Gospels, namely the spiritual and the temporal, one being the religious, the other being the governmental. Therefore, both are in the power of the church, namely the spiritual and the temporal sword. The latter is to be used for the church, the former by the church. And then, let's see, I'll go over here and I'll quote you one more out of this. This is about two pages long. Furthermore, we decree that every human creature is subject to the Roman pontiff. This we declare, say, define, and pronounce to be altogether necessary to salvation. So when people accuse you of attacking somebody else's religion, just get it in writing. They're the ones that said you can't be saved without belonging to their church, and you can't get to heaven unless you submit to the Pope at Rome. That's what they said. Okay, I've got it in Latin as well as in English. Now what happens, I mean, you consider if you're a king, and all of your loyal subjects are good Catholics, and all at once the Pope says, hey, if you don't submit to me, you're out. You've got some pretty difficult choices to make. And, of course, you'd wonder what the choice was, and it was the choice that was made that kind of marks what's going to take place in Europe for the next 200 years. Philip the Fair, who is king of France at this time, involved in the battle with England, Philip the Fair reads Unum Sanctum, and he replies to Unum Sanctum by arresting Boniface VIII and placing him in prison. Boniface, the Catholic Pope, dies in prison. Under the hand of Philip the Fair, captures him, puts him in prison. And Unum Sanctum, by the way, was issued 1294, I believe. Philip the Fair puts him in prison. He dies in prison. Upon his death, Benedict the 11th is placed in the Roman Catholic papacy. He only lives 9 months, and there's kind of some doubt as to how he died and under what conditions he died, but it is evident that he was not going to toe the rope either. And so whether it was Philip or whether it was the King of England, nobody really knows, but somebody put an end to his life very shortly. And interestingly enough, Clement V is elected the next Roman Catholic Pope. Now, I don't expect you to memorize all these names, but it's important you know what takes place. Clement V, his papacy extended from 1305 to 1314, was Philip the Fair's buddy. They had been friends long before. Philip the Fair actually went down and addressed the cardinals to see that Clement was set up in the papal chair. And as soon as Clement V was elected, he moved the papal headquarters from Rome, Italy, to Avignon, France. How many of you ever knew that the papacy did not always exist in the Vatican? For 70 years, the popes ruled from Avignon, France. It's called the Babylonian exile in Roman Catholic Church history. Of course, most Roman Catholics don't even know their own church history. The papacy was moved to Avignon, France, and for the next 70 years, seven French popes sat on the throne, or at least in the papal chair there, in Avignon, France. And Philip the Fair, of course, being the guy that kind of governed the whole thing, that's one way to get control. You'll find what goes on in Europe is either the papal chair is ruling Europe or else somebody's ruling the papal chair. That's what goes on for about 400 or 500 years back and forth through here. At each meeting or each council of the Catholic Church, there was always a call to return the papal throne. Avignon, France is right up in this area in here. And there's always a desire to return the papal chair back to the Vatican. But for some reason, they just never can get it done. Finally, in 1377, Gregory the 11th returns to Rome to die. He had lived out his life and had had his position as Pope, and he decided to go back and die in Rome. And he does. And when he does, Urban VI is elected to the position of the new Pope only after he promises to come back to Avignon, France. That was one of the terms for his election. So Urban VI is elected, and after he is elected, he reneges on his promise. He says, no, I'm going to stay down here in Rome. But now you got a real problem, because the College of Cardinals is up here in Avignon, France. And the Pope is down here in Rome. So what does the Cardinals do? They get together and they elect another Pope, Clement VI. And so you have two popes, both of them calling each other the Antichrist and cursing one another. Both of them excommunicating the other one. It's a big fiasco, one of the most humorous points in church history other than for what's going to happen next. There are two popes. And they argue with one another over who really has the authority. And of course, both of them are infallible. It's kind of rough when you have two infallible popes condemning one another to hellfire. And yet, if you read the documents of the church at that time, that's what you'll find took place. I mean, back and forth, just blam, 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 blam. And obviously, this causes much consternation in all of the Holy Roman Empire here. What's going to be done? So finally, in 1409, I need some water. Thank you, Brother Bob. It's going after it. In 1409, a council was convened in Pisa, over here in Italy, up in northern Italy. And the council was there, first of all, and primarily to determine what are we going to do with two popes? How do we handle the situation? And so in the midst of this council, what they did is they declared both seats of the papacy null and void, and by unanimous decision, they elected Alexander V as the pope. The only problem was that the two existing popes, neither one recognized the council. And so now you have three popes at one time. And all three of them infallible, all three of them speaking ex cathedra as God, and all three of them condemning one another to hell. And so you have a period through here, and this actually goes on till 1417, when finally, for the sake of humility, they decide there really should only be one pope, and Martin V is declared as the pope, and finally we go back to a one-pope setting. But you had one pope, two popes, three popes. Take your choice, whichever one you want. And they all hated each other. They were all dividing everything up. Now, all in all, this occupies France, the French territory. And what I wanted you to see, the reason I showed you this, is because England begins to be isolated. Oh, that's good. You people wouldn't believe how good that is. England and France are at war. And again, this area is inhabited by millions and millions of Catholic people. And all at once, France becomes the controlling agency of the papacy. What do you suppose that does to England? I mean, for instance, if you're fighting a war against France and all at once France becomes the headquarters of the papacy and 90% of your subjects are Roman Catholics, you see the problem you're getting into? What do you do? Well, that deepens the feeling of nationalism among the English people. We say, why is that important? It's going to be extremely important before we're all finished. What happens is Edward III, immediately upon the Avignon papacy, declares that in England, all bishops and priests will be elected by a common vote of the people. First time that had ever been done. You see, normally the papal chair, the papal see, determined who would be the bishops and the archbishops in a particular country, who would be the papal sees and the prelates in that particular country. But now, all at once, Edward says, we'll elect them ourselves. And further isolating him, because the Catholic Church didn't care for that too much, and so he responds to their response by declaring it treason for an English subject to accept jurisdiction of any papal court outside of England. And in essence, Edward cut off England from the rest of the Catholic monarchies that were down in Europe. You say, why is that important? Because it isolates them. It isolates them. What has this got to do with Christopher Columbus? This is the generation that Christopher Columbus grew up, but this was his heritage. This was what he studied. If he went to school and studied history, this is what he studied. This is what he saw going on, and it just waxes worse and worse and worse until the 15th century when Martin Luther rebels. And this is what's going on. Now, let me give you some characters of this time that will give you some ideas about what's going on in Europe. By the way, these men I'm going to mention all have something in common, and I'll tell you what it is when I'm finished. John Wycliffe, up in England, during the Avignon papacy, Wycliffe was an educator. He served on the king's court and the king's council, and he became very disillusioned with the papacy. I would assume you probably would when there are two popes and then three popes. And when he became disillusioned with the papacy, he returned to the scriptures and began to study the scriptures, and they gave him some very interesting viewpoints. As he began to study the scriptures, he started writing, and his writing became some of the most inflammatory statements that were made at that time against Roman Catholicism. As a matter of fact, John Wycliffe is called the Morning Star of the Reformation. The Reformation actually began with John Wycliffe, not Martin Luther. John Wycliffe began to write, first of all, he attacked the doctrine of transubstantiation as a doctrine from hell. And he used the scriptures to prove it. And that didn't make him any points, I'm sure. And then he secondly set out in the scriptures and proved that there was no distinction between a bishop and a presbyter or a priest or a preacher, but that the Roman Catholic Church had developed their own system that gave degrees of honor to different men. And of course, he ended up at refuting the infallibility of the Pope, and that just didn't sit real well with anybody. One of the characteristics, or one of the important things that John Wycliffe did up in England, John Wycliffe in 1382 translated the old Latin Bible into English for the very first time. And Wycliffe doing so violated several bans. As a matter of fact, there were in almost every country in Europe, there was a monarchy ban against reading the scriptures. A lot of people don't know that. You were forbidden to read the scriptures in your own language. You were forbidden to read it in Latin. And Wycliffe violated an old outstanding law and translated the scriptures. He did not use the Vulgate, which was the common use of the Catholic Church. He used the old Latin on which Jerome had worked and translated the Vulgate. We're going to go into Jerome and his corruption, but Jerome had produced the Latin Vulgate. It did not match the manuscripts that he translated from. Jerome screwed the old Latin up so badly that when he was all finished, the Vulgate was one of the most corrupt Bibles on the face of the earth. And what Wycliffe did, he went back and got the old Italian manuscripts and the old Latin manuscripts from which the Vulgate had come and translated an English version of the Bible. And in 1399, when Wycliffe was gone, but what had happened is, through his translating the scriptures, those scriptures had to be lettered by hand. There was no printing press at this time. All scriptures had to be copied by hand. And Wycliffe and his followers, they became known as the Lollards. That word means poor priests. And the Lollards began to translate these scriptures by hand, lettered by hand. And to show you what kind of work they did, of all the work that they did, I think there are around 1,200 copies of that Bible still in existence, even though it was banned by both England and by the papacy and burned by the boatload. There's still, I believe, 1,200 copies of that originally hand-lettered Bible in existence. That shows you how much work they did. And the statement, I believe, was it took 7 years to complete copying one Bible. That'll tell you what kind of work they were involved in there. Wycliffe organized the poor priests. And he said this, he said that the papacy's desire had become nothing more than silver and gold and empires, and they had forgotten the souls of men. So he sent the Lollards out, he trained them to get a job and work with their own hands to support themselves. And he trained them to go everywhere they could go, find a job, go to work, and do nothing more than preach and pray to the people that were there. He taught them they were not above the people, but if they wanted to be great, they had to be the servant of all men. And these priests went out, they made such a marked influence on England that when, let me get his name here, King Henry IV, 1399, took the throne. He was an ardent papist. He was trying to return the papacy's power to England. And the first thing that he did was issue a ban against the Lollards and call for their excommunication and extermination. And from then, for 150 years, the Lollards were legal game. In other words, they could be killed without a trial. If you found a Lollard, you could have him burned at the stake, and thousands of them were. In 1414, he continued by placing a ban on the reading of the English scriptures. I'll read it to you. Reading of the English scriptures is forbidden upon pain of forfeiture of land, cattle, life, and goods from all heirs forever. In other words, if you were caught reading the Bible in 1414, you could lose your home, your land, and everything. Even your heirs could not inherit your possessions. It's kind of unusual why somebody would want to keep the Bible away from you. Strange, I guess. But Wycliffe dies. Wycliffe is condemned to death by the Roman Catholic Church, but they can't get to him because there are too many Lollards around, too many people that support. There's actually almost a revival going on in England. And so Wycliffe dies in church after preaching a sermon, preaches his last sermon and leaves this world. He's buried, and in 1413, after he's been dead and buried probably 20 years or 30 years or so, in order to get their full revenge, the Roman Catholic Church has his bones dug up, and they are burned, and his ashes are scattered on the Thames River. I mean, I got him finally, you know, they had to get him. And in 1415, his books are ordered burned by the papal see in Rome. Any book of John Wycliffe, if you're found with it, is punishable by death. And his books are called to be burned. You say, what's important about John Wycliffe? I'll tell you something about him in a minute. Over on the continent, while this is going on in England, over in Bohemia, which now would be Austria, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, that area in there, there was a fellow by the name of John Huss. And John Huss was teaching at, I believe he was in Prague, if I'm not mistaken, at a great theological university in Prague. And while he was there, someone gave him a copy of a book. It happened to be the writings of John Wycliffe. And when Huss read those writings, he took a Bible and began to compare that Bible with what Wycliffe had said, and he became one of the most ardent anti-papists in that area of the country. And began condemning the actions and the activities of the Catholic Church and of the popes in particular. And, of course, he was excommunicated and threatened. His life was threatened. He was excommunicated in 1410, and he was burned at the stake in 1415 by Rome after being promised in writing that if he would attend a council, which was to try and patch things up, he would be granted and promised safe conduct both to the council and home. And that's a public document that you can read, signed by the Roman Catholic Pope, promised if he'd come to the council to help iron out the problems, he would be given free passage both there and home. When he gets there, the first thing on the agenda is the trial of John Huss. The next thing on the agenda is he's burned at the stake. That was what they desired the whole time through. But because of his stand, two groups arise, actually three groups arise in this area of the country. First of all, the Hussites. The Hussites being those that were taught and followed and understood the teachings of John Huss. Another group that was there are called the Waldensians. The Waldensians. And Bohemia was one of the capitals of the Waldensians. Another one is the Bohemian Brethren. Three groups. You say, are these Protestants? No, there is no Protestant yet. There is no Reformation yet. You say, why are you telling this? Because I want you to understand your roots. You did not come out of the Catholic Church during the Reformation. You say, what did these people believe? I'll give it to you in just a minute, but it's remarkable that most of you believe pretty much the same thing. Another fellow that you need to understand who he was Girolamo Savonarola. And you want to write that down? Too bad. Just write Savonarola. All right? Savonarola was born and raised in Italy, northern Italy. His lifespan was from 1452 to 1498. So Savonarola was alive at the time of Columbus. Savonarola was trained as a Dominican. And up in northern Italy, another strange group up here, you have the Waldensians in southern France. You have the Albigensians. And you say, who are these groups? These are groups that are really causing great problems to the Catholic Church. If you wanted to compare what they all believed and what they all had in common, you'd have to call them Bible believers. The Waldensians, the Albigensians, the Catharii, which was an arm of the Catholic Church, the Bohemian Brethren, the Hussites, the Lollards, they had some things they disagreed upon. But the keystone of all that they believed and the keystone of their opposition to the Catholic Church was that they believed the Bible was the supreme authority rather than the Pope. And these groups number probably up into the 50s or 60s of thousands of people. And so Savonarola trains a Dominican, moves, and he's up in northern Italy. Up in northern Italy, he becomes exposed to what some of these people are preaching. He listens and reasons, and before long, Savonarola becomes the most ardent anti-papist in all of Italy. Reminded you, he's a Roman Catholic priest. And that's what these men have in common. They're all Roman Catholics. John Wycliffe is a Catholic priest. John Huss is a Catholic priest. Savonarola is a Catholic priest. I'm not condemning anybody's religion. This is what they did. Martin Luther is a Catholic priest, a Roman Catholic monk. The problems of the Catholic Church came from within the Catholic Church. Savonarola begins to preach on the evils of the priesthood and the papacy. And of course, as close as he was to Rome and Avignon, he just literally blasts the thing and puts it out for everybody to see. The Waldensians, the Catharii, the Fratricelli. That C-E is a C-H sound, is that correct? Okay. Fratricelli, which is Italian for poor priests. This was an offshoot of the Lowards. These are the groups that were up there in northern Italy. Pope Alexander VI attempts to silence him by offering him a cardinal seat in the Vatican. The documents record how that he offered him a seat as a cardinal in the Vatican if he would just cease and subsist with the preaching. If he just stopped the preaching, they'd make him a cardinal. His reply to that was, "I'd rather have a red hat of blood than to sit on set with the papacy in Rome." He was condemned to die and condemned to be burned at the stake. When they bound him hand and foot and led him to the stake, the papal prelate stated he said this, quote, "I separate thee from the church militant and the church triumphant." Savonarola looked at him and he said, quote, "Not from the church triumphant, that is not thine to do." Savonarola stated that without God's presence, you see, the papal infallibility here was in question. Obviously, with two and three popes, people began to wonder, well, who's the big dog on the block? And when they returned to the scriptures and found out that papal supremacy had no bearing at all in the scriptures, they began to argue against it. The thing that got Savonarola in trouble was he stated that without God's presence, the pope was merely a broken tool. Well, that upset him. It really did, and got him so upset that they burned him at the stake. In 1492, under papal decree, the Jews are banned from Europe. They're commanded to leave all their possessions. They're not allowed to take anything with them. They have to leave the European continent. That's what Columbus was fighting with, trying to get his ships. The reason he couldn't get the ships that he wanted, he took the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. One of the ships, the Santa Maria, was not the ship that he wanted. He wanted to take what was called a caravel, a fast ship, a light ship. The Santa Maria was not a caravel. It was a heavier ship. He could not obtain another caravel because the Jews were literally being thrown out of the country with nothing. The ships were packed with Jews, literally with nowhere to go. And they were thrown out as heretics. They were declared so by the Inquisition. The Inquisition was founded by Dominic, who has now been sainted by the Roman Catholic Church. Dominic was responsible for probably 15 times more deaths than Adolf Hitler ever caused in his life. If you ever read the account of the Inquisition, which began first of all in Italy, then went to Spain, France, the Inquisition was called for by the popes to cleanse heretical blood from the purity of the Catholic Church. That's a quote. That was the purpose. And during that period of time, you could be imprisoned, tortured, whatever, only upon accusation of crimes committed against the Church. And one of those crimes was not submitting to the authority and the supremacy of the Pope. Saint Dominic founded it. That's where the Dominicans come from. They were the runners of the fellows that established and ran the Inquisition. It was established in 1254, and it operated in Spain until 1820. The Spanish Inquisition was not forbidden by law until 1820. That's not that long ago. On October the 23rd, to give you an idea of how far-fetched this thing was, on October the 23rd in 1641, 150,000 Protestants were killed in Ireland in one day. 150,000, and you hear about the trouble in Northern Ireland, made out to be an English and an Irish problem. Ian Paisley's been denied a visa to the United States of America. Ian Paisley is a member of the British Parliament. He's called a Catholic hater. Let me tell you why he's called a Catholic hater. Because Ulster was founded as a protected haven of Protestants. That's why you have, and there's no such thing as Northern Ireland. There's Ireland and there's Ulster. The press changed it to Ireland and Northern Ireland to make you think they ought to all be linked together, kind of like North Korea, South Korea. There is no such country as Northern Ireland. It does not exist. There is Ulster and there is Ireland. Ulster was established by William of Orange as a haven for the Protestants who were being murdered by the millions. And again, if you don't believe that, check out history. It's kind of amazing. People get upset, think you're kind of angry and upset. I'm not. I'm giving you factual quotes. I can prove everything I'm saying this morning. October the 23rd, 1641, 150,000 Protestants were killed in one day. Why? In an attempt to purge heresy from the purity of the Catholic Church. You say, why are you giving us all this? I want you to see what kind of condition Europe is in. You know, we kind of get the picture of people living in little houses with thatched roofs, you know, and little plants growing around the outside. Europe is in great turmoil when Columbus sails for looking for the West Indies. For instance, the historian Laurent states that in Spain, between 1480 and 1498, 8,000 people were burned at the stake alone. Burned at the stake. And 90,000 more were punished with imprisonment, loss of limbs, and torture. From 1499 to 1506, there were 1,600 people burned alive in Spain alone. From 1507 to 1515, that's a period of 8 years, 2,536 people burned alive at the stake in Spain alone to purge the heresy. The totals for Spain during these periods of time were 150,000 people burned at the stake. The historian Dowling states that during the period of the Inquisition, more than 1 million Waldensians were executed in France alone. 36,000 people were burned at the stake in Holland. You say, why are you saying all this? Because when you begin to study American history, you hear about all the bad guys over here, you know, killing Indians and how. You don't hear this stuff. This is what was going on in Europe. You hear about Salem, the settlement in America. Somebody tell me what happened at Salem. Witches trial. You know how many witches were burned in Salem? If I'm not mistaken, there are less than 30 witches burned in American history. But you hear about all the mean guys that burned witches. Did you know that there were 30,000 witches executed under the Inquisition in northern Italy? 30,000 declared to be witches and executed in northern Italy. Why don't you hear about that witch purge? Why isn't that in the history books? I've got a history book in my office that they teach kids out of right now. You'll find several pages about the burning of witches at Salem and what an atrocity it was. What about the 30,000 in northern Italy? History's been tainted for a long time. By the way, Laurent is a Roman Catholic historian. Dowling is a Catholic historian. They're not Protestants. So if the figures are padded, I would assume they're padded down. All of that gave rise to the condition that exists in Europe at this time. Suffice it to say, extreme turmoil. If you're a Roman Catholic, you're watching two and three popes argue back and forth as to who has the supreme power. You're watching the popes exercise their dominion over the civil governments of Europe. You're watching the Roman Catholic Church issue excommunication after excommunication. You're watching people begin to be burned at the stake who disagree with the Roman Catholic Church. So if you're a Roman Catholic, at best there's massive confusion. What's going on? If you belong to one of the other groups, the Catharii, the Fraticelli, the Waldensians, the Albigensians, you're hiding, trying to save your life. This purge was nothing like what Hitler did in Germany. Nothing. It was a dozen times broader and more extensive than what Hitler did in Germany. And yet not a mention of it anywhere in the history books. Columbus grew up, born in Italy, was raised there, was trained by some Roman Catholic monks in a monastery whose viewpoints seemed to be somewhat at odds with the Catholic Church, strangely enough. Whether they were Cathari or no, I do not know, but Cathari was a whole bunch of priests that organized themselves against the wickedness of the Catholic Church. Christopher was raised in that era, and at an early age, Christopher went to sea for the first time and became fascinated with seafaring and sea voyages. Columbus became convinced that the world was round. He used the most modern map in existence in his day, and from those things and his own calculations, he calculated that the earth was spherical in shape. He sat on the shores, and he'd watched the ships leave. And he said himself that the thought dawned on him for the first time, he believed, by divine revelation. Columbus always maintained that his beliefs were divine revelation. And he said he sat on the cliffs one day and watched as the ships would leave, and he noticed as the ships would journey that they would disappear. But they didn't just disappear, they sank. In other words, he could see the whole ship, and then he could just see from the deck up, and then he could just see from the yard arm up, and then he could just see the top of the mast, and it caused him to realize the earth was round. And as those ships left, they weren't actually sinking, they were just following the curvature of the earth. Columbus took the maps of his day and began to calculate, and calculated, I believe, to within 150 leagues, the exact distance that it would take him to find landfall traveling to the west from Spain, which is pretty interesting. He was only 150 leagues off, and most of his calculations were wrong. If you go back and look at Columbus's calculations, he's like most of us adding up the grocery bill or balancing our checkbook. he made some real blunders. And then the map that he was working with was flawed. And so really, the fact that he ended up just 150 leagues off is not just good mathematics. It's actually, the direct involvement of God himself. Because Columbus had messed up, the cartographers had messed up, the map makers had messed up, and yet Columbus ended up 150 leagues from his destination. Columbus set sail in 1492. I said before, first of all, Columbus had appealed to the King of England. Why England? I don't know. But Columbus had gone to England and appealed there to the court that he would like to be outfitted, believed that he could find a passage to the Indies. And of course, at this time, the only way to get to the Indies were the spices and the tea, the silks, all the finery of the world could be found, was overland. Nobody had realized you could sail to the Indies. The only routes were the trade routes that went across the European continent and down through the Middle East and over that direction to arrive at the West Indies, which opened up the door for a lot of marauding and a lot of terrorist attacks, if we can use that word. But very rarely did a caravan get all the way to the Indies and back without being raided several times. And so when Columbus offered to the King of England an opportunity to sail to the Indies by traveling west, the king took it under consideration. He gave it to his scientists, the most knowledgeable men in England, who considered what Columbus had set down on paper and laughed him to scorn. And Columbus was basically ridiculed as a buffoon by the scientists in England. Columbus then went to Portugal, same story. He was laughed as being a maniac by the scientists. You say, why are you saying that? I just want you to remember where scientists came from. The scientists believed the earth was flat. Finally, he went to Spain, where he knew a friar that had been the confessor of Queen Isabella herself. And this fellow presented the plan to Ferdinand and Isabella, and they thought he was crazy. So did all their scientists. But one stroke of luck occurred in Columbus's favor, and that was the defeat of the final Moorish outpost in Spain. For the first time in 1700 years, the Moors had been driven out of Spain, and Spain now was its own country once again. At that defeat, Columbus appeared, and Ferdinand and Isabella had decided they wanted to do something for God because of their victory. And when Columbus showed up, Columbus' statement was, Columbus really was looking for a route to the Indies, but if you read Columbus's writing, his desire was to take the gospel to foreign lands. I find that quoted about 17 times in his own diary. That's what his desire was. And when he presented that to the king and queen of Spain, they provided him with the funding necessary to set sail for a long voyage across the ocean. Let me get another map up here now. Martin Pizan and Vicente Pizan were the captains. Let me get this up here right. Is that up right? No, that's not up right. That's not up right. That's up right. Now you may recognize this. Martin Pizan, Vicente Pizan commanded the Nina and the Pinta. Columbus took command of the flagship, the Santa Maria, and set sail from somewhere down here in southern Spain, passing through the Straits of Gibraltar and headed out into the open sea with absolutely no idea of what was going to happen. They traveled as far as the Azores, which are not on this map, but are actually located out in this area right in there. Traveled out to the Azores, where they re-equipped their ships and again set sail to the southwest, not knowing where they were going to end up, and traveled for days and days and days and days and days and days with absolutely no sight of land, no hint of land, nothing at all. So much so that on October the 9th, 1492, a day that Columbus did not even record in his diary, but both Vicente Pizan and Martin Pizan recorded in their ship's logs, those two captains were taken aboard the Santa Maria for a conference with Columbus. And their statements were this: we are on the verge of mutiny. Our crews have already decided that they are going to turn back and execute the captains of the ships. They're tired of this venture. It's coming to nothing. We haven't seen anything, and we're about to run out of supplies. Columbus, foolhardy or not, I don't know. But Columbus stated to those men, give me 3 more days. And if we don't find anything in 3 days, I'll turn back. That was October the 9th. They traveled on. A day or two later, they found a reed floating in the water, which gave them hope that they were fixing to come upon land, although they had no guarantee. On October the 12th, 1492, at 2 o'clock in the morning, 4 hours before the deadline, from the top of the mast of the Pinta, someone shouted, "Land," and Columbus had, for the first time, navigated the Atlantic Ocean and arrived at a small, tiny little island right down in here. It was one of the most beautiful places they had ever seen, and as the sun came up, they took the longboats and rowed ashore. Upon arriving on the shore, Columbus prayed these words: O Lord Almighty and everlasting God, by thy holy word thou hast created the heaven and the earth and the sea. Blessed and glorified be thy name, and praised be thy majesty, which hath deigned to use us, thy humble servants, that thy holy name may be proclaimed in this second part of the earth. The word Christopher means the bearer of Christ. And Columbus had landed on an island that he named San Salvador, the Holy Savior. Now, if you have any doubt as to what Columbus believed, just look at what he did. San Salvador, the Holy Savior. Columbus set up on that island there. The natives met him. They were friendly. They were a beautiful people. I won't go into all the things that he wrote about the people that are there. He set out to explore the rest of the area. One thing that happened to Columbus, and one problem Columbus had, is probably no different than you and I, and that is he was a human being. And Columbus began to notice some of the natives on that island were wearing little rings of gold in their ears, in their noses, little jewelry of gold, and he began to ask, where does the gold come from? I mean, after all, it was one thing to go back to England or back to Spain and state that you had discovered a new land or had found a passage. He still believed, actually, till the day he died, he was in the Indies. And he never did know he discovered a new country. But he believed he had found the Indies, and what better way to go home than to say, I found a passage to the Indies, and look at all the gold that I brought home. He began to ask, and the Indians said, well, you know, it comes from an island, comes from another place. And so Columbus took one of his ships and began to go a-sailing. Now, remember this. What's going on in the 14th century in Europe? The argument is over papal dominion and who runs the show. Now, I want you to know that, because that's what Columbus has behind him as he comes looking for a new world. Columbus stands at San Salvador. He leaves there on a voyage and journeys all over here to the island of Cuba. He traverses the whole northern part of the island of Cuba and decides that he will turn north to see what he can find, not knowing that 90 miles to the north of where he was the largest and the greatest nation that was ever to be discovered. When Columbus set sail, bearing to the north, all at once that wind direction changed and the headwinds blew him to such an extent that he could make no progress to the north. And he had to abandon his voyage to the north. You say, why are you saying that? I just wondered who controlled the wind. Somebody kept Columbus from getting to America. Why? I believe, and I'll show you next week, because of what Columbus would have brought to America in 1492 from Europe. Papal dominion. And God would not allow it to be so. You say, all that's stupid. Not so stupid at all when you consider the fact that Cortez and Coronado came behind Spanish explorers, came behind Columbus, went ashore here, and came up the west coast and killed millions and millions of Indians looking for gold and established Roman Catholicism in Mexico, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. They came on up the coast of Western America and established San Diego, Los Angeles, Spanish names. Which part of the American continent was poverty stricken until the gold rush pulled settlers across this country into California? October 26, he landed in Cuba. His efforts to go north were thwarted by strong headwinds that drove him back. He turned back. He landed at the island of Espanola. Espanola is right here. On the island of Espanola, he founded the first colony called La Navidad, the Nativity. While he was here, one of the Pinzon brothers decided he was going to go looking for gold and just sailed out of the harbor with the Nina. It was gone. Now they were down to two ships. Another tragedy was while they were there and establishing this island, the Santa Maria caught the tide and was hung up and sank right in the harbor, which left them with one ship. And the decision was made then to leave 39 men behind. And Columbus would take 38 men on the other boat and attempt to return to England with the news of what had happened. On the way back, by the way, they ran into the Nina. They hadn't found any gold, but they followed them back into Spain several months behind. But they left the country, headed back for Spain. A year later, when they returned to La Navidad, they found of the 39 men they had left behind, every one of them was dead. And the stories began to unfold of what had happened. No more had Columbus sailed out of sight than the 39 men who were left, desirous of gold, began to persecute the Indians, to kill them, to rape, pillage, and steal. So much so that the Indians turned and rebelled and executed them all. To give you an idea of what took place, in 2 years after Columbus established a colony at La Navidad, there were 300,000 natives on the island of Espanola. 2 years later, there was 100,000 left. 4 years later, 20,000 were alive. The Spaniards killed 280,000 Indians looking for gold. That's why I don't believe God allowed Columbus to set foot in America. God kept America preserved. Columbus's men left behind them smallpox, which was to be the scourge of the Indians. Millions and millions and millions of Indians died from smallpox. But they returned to England and they carried something back to England. Other than gold, they carried syphilis, which would almost eliminate the European continent. So they traded off one for the other. Columbus's third trip, he discovered the island of Trinidad. On his fourth trip, he returned to Espanola and sailed on over to the countries. He followed the coastline of Honduras, Guatemala, right down through there, searching for gold. And I maintain the problem with Columbus was the fact that he lost sight of what he wanted to do and stated so in his later writings. He got preoccupied with the finding of gold and forgot the souls of the Indians that he went to reach. Cortez, in 1519, would follow the footsteps of Columbus and arrive on the Mexican soil, first man to set foot in Mexico City, where he captured the king of the Aztec Indians, Montezuma, two of the greatest Indian nations that ever existed, the Incas and the Aztecs. You can attribute the extinction of both of them to Spanish conquerors. Cortez took Montezuma as his prisoner, executed him, controlled the country, and destroyed the Aztec culture. Pizarro, in 1531, would land in Peru and do the same thing to the Incas. He killed the chief, he took the chief captive, and told them if he wanted their chief back, he wanted a room filled with gold to the very ceiling. They provided it. And then he garroted the king while they were watching and destroyed him, destroyed the country. Coronado landed and set foot, as I said, up through Texas into California looking for the seven cities of gold. 1513, Ponce de Leon landed in Florida, the first Spaniard to land on the American continent, looking for the Fountain of Youth. He attempted to establish a continent or a colony, but could not do so. The people that he put there were either died with the fever of the marshes and the swamp land, or were killed by the Seminole Indians, who were ferocious Indians. And the colony was lost. In 1562, French Huguenots, remember they're the dissenters from Europe, now the dissenters are starting to come. The anti-papists, they establish a colony at Beaufort, South Carolina. More of them follow and establish a colony at the mouth of the St. John's River down in Florida, which is right around St. Augustine. The colony of St. Augustine is massacred by Spanish conquerors later on. Every man, woman, and child in the colony is killed. You don't read that in textbooks. The Spaniards were out for gold, and they died. We've got to close. Man, I got a lot of stuff to go here. All right, let's close right there. We'll close with the French Huguenots beginning to arrive in what we now call continental America. No Spanish conqueror was allowed to thrive in the continental United States. You tell me why. I maintain to you that at that time they carried with them the seeds of papal dominion that God would not allow to occupy this country. And I'll show you that next week when we're finished. Yes? Columbus was not, no. Columbus was, like I said, he was one of those Catholics that was confused. You can find places in his writings where he abhorred some of the vices of the Catholic Church and the Catholic papacy. But he was, where else do you go? If you renounce Catholicism, you suffer being burned at the stake. And it was a Roman Catholic king and queen that had given him his money to come to America. He certainly was not going to turn against the church who was funding his exploration. And he claimed all the lands he found for the king and queen of Spain, which meant all of them were under their dominion, thereby being under the dominion of the Roman Catholic priest or pontiff. All right? Okay, we'll take a break. Next week, we'll be back at it again.